You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On the second of my four Halloween special episodes, it's a warm welcome back to paranormal author and investigator Ruth Roper Wild. As Ruth works on finalising her next book, which will be a second volume of The Roadmap of British Ghosts, we discuss some of our favourite spooky encounters from These Haunted Times, Volume 2. From encounters with ghosts in the road, to a Ouija board frightening a group of teenagers, disembodied voices, and haunted hotel rooms, there's a plethora of paranormal encounters, as well as one of my favourite stories, which involves a disappearing sausage. It was lovely to spend some time in Ruth's company once again, and I'll be looking forward to her return when the new book is released, hopefully soon. As always, before we get there, you can support the show by signing up to Patreon for $4 a month for ad-free episodes, bonus content, and early releases. The link is in the show notes, or you can search for Mysteries and Monsters on patreon.com. Mysteries and Monsters is available on all social media networks, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. The website is, of course, mysteriesandmonsters.com, and you can get yourself t-shirts, mugs, and more by clicking our merchandise tabs on the top of the page. Thank you, as always, for his artwork to my brother, Dean Bestel. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So turn the lights down low, pour yourself a bracing drink, and join myself and Ruth in the company of some creepy witness encounters. As we continue to enjoy this spookiest of months, I'm delighted to be able to welcome back the marvellous Ruth Roper Wild to the show. With five marvellous books under her belt, Ruth's latest book, a follow-up to The Roadmap of British Ghosts, promises to be released in the next coming months. Ruth.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Ruth, welcome back to the show.
Hi, everyone. Thanks ever so much for having me back again. Always a pleasure to be back.
Oh, you are very welcome. And as I mentioned in our introduction, here we are, October, a spooky month, and it's been quite interesting since the last time we've spoken. Obviously, we're allowed to go more places than we have been in our previous conversations, Ruth, which is quite an interesting scenario to be in. And I've found myself visiting a few haunted locations as well, so you've certainly had an effect on me in that regard.
Well, that's good to hear, because the more people that get out there to the haunted places, take your camera, take your digital recorder with you, and then don't forget to email me with what you saw or heard, or I can put into the books.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I have nothing to contribute so far.
But persistence pays off.
Absolutely.
Took me nearly a year to see one of the things I was hunting down, but I saw it in the end, so.
Well, it is one of those things as well, and it's been always refreshing, Ruth, to keep up to date with your adventures as you traverse the locations around the country looking for new and exciting stories around there. So how has it been this year in regards to the gathering of stories? Because I think the last time we spoke, you were saying that you were creaking under the contributions you were receiving. Is that still going on?
Do you know, it's absolutely wonderful, but it's also insane. I put out a request about a particular location because I've come across a source story or whatever. And as well as the replies that I was looking for, you know, that particular location, inevitably, most people that respond to me seem to say, oh, yes, I've got something about that that you're asking about. But I also visited such and such a place or lived in such and such a house or when I was a child, we had a farm that whatever. And they have another story with another location. So as fast as I sort of research one location, I get another six. I can't go this fast. Which is absolutely brilliant because, I mean, some of the stories are just so genuine. And, you know, the people have absolutely nothing to gain by contacting me with anything but a genuine story.
Mm.
And just so good of them to share their experiences. And some of them, in fact, a lot of them actually, will say to me, I don't actually believe in the paranormal. You know, I don't believe in ghosts. I don't believe in life after death. But this thing happened to me, you know, and they'll recount their tale to me. And sometimes I have to chuckle and say, well, you might not believe in the paranormal, but it seems to believe in you. I mean, I had a chap just the other day, because I'm researching for, as you said a moment ago, I'm researching for book number 6 at the moment, which is The Roadmap of British Ghosts, Volume 2, back by popular demand. A chap then had an absolutely fascinating short snippet of a story to tell me.
Hmm.
And he said, I don't believe in the paranormal. I don't believe in ghosts. But I can't explain what I saw. So I said, OK, go on then, tell me. You know, he said, it's not about that road you were asking about, but it was somewhere nearby.
Hmm.
So it was a chap who whose grandfather had bought a plot of land, and they were using it to scrap cars and to restore old vintage cars on.
Mm.
And this land, many, many years ago, was the site of a World War One army camp. So there were sort of concrete bases of what had been buildings, but now grown over with scrub trees and scrub land and so on. Anyway, this particular night, he'd got a call out at 2 o'clock in the morning to somebody who'd broken down and desperately needed a repair wheel for this vintage vehicle delivering. So he'd gone out to the yard to load his van with the wheels that this person needed. He was busy loading his van, but he heard something behind him and turned round. And there walking towards him, plain as day, is what he described as a well-set chap wearing dark-coloured trousers with braces over some kind of white T-shirt or shirt. Quite a big lad, quite heavy set, sort of marching towards him. And he thought, oh, crikey, here we go. In the middle of the night, I'm out here on my own, you know. So he's hurriedly trying to shove everything quickly in the van and get the door shut because he doesn't want them trying to get into the van or anything like that, get at his tools. Turns to face the bloke, who is still striding towards him and is now only about 6 feet away from him. And as he turns to face him, the bloke says, what are you doing here? So he opens his mouth to answer, well, actually, mate, we own this land. What are you doing here? But as he opened his mouth and he says, the chap was right in front of him. By this time, he was almost within his personal space. He was about, 3 feet in front of him at this point. And he could see him as solid as day, could smell him. Totally ordinary human being stood there. And then suddenly he wasn't.
Oh.
Blinked out of existence right in front of him. He didn't glance away. He wasn't turned away. Quite often when people see a disappearing figure, they say, I glanced away for a second. When I looked back, it had gone.
Mm.
This chap actually is as solid as you or I are. And everything about him was saying solid human being. Just suddenly blinked out of existence right in front of his eyes, having just spoken to him.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said to him, do you realise how rare that is to see such a full-on solid apparition or whatever you want to call it, that to all intents and purposes is entirely three-dimensional and solid, and you're saying you could even sort of smell, that there was a human being near you, and he spoke to you. So you've got sight, sound, scent all being triggered. And then the spirit said, that is so rare. And he said, well, if you say so. He said, I don't really believe in the paranormal, so I don't read anything about it. I don't really know much about it. I just can't explain where that bloke went because I was looking right at him. How amazing.
I mean, that as well, Ruth, as this gentleman says, he doesn't believe in the paranormal. So I would be very interested, or even when you've spoken to him, how is he trying to rationalise what's happened to him then?
He's just utterly at a loss to rationalise it and has just parked it in a sort of box in his mind that says, yep, can't explain that. Not even going to try to. And says the only reason he thought of it was because he saw my post about the road I was asking about, which he did have a story relating to, which will be in the book. And then when talking to me, you know, that triggered him to think, oh, by the way, I had this other weird thing. Are you interested? You know. And it's just it's gems that come out of these conversations, you know, because a lot of the witnesses, if possible, I do try and talk to them in person if I can, you know, over the phone or whatever. Although I have met them in person as well. I'm not averse to having a cup of coffee if someone's near enough.
Yes.
But yeah, I prefer if I can to speak to them firsthand. Not always possible, of course. So sometimes it's done by email or messaging or whatever.
Yeah.
But speaking firsthand, you know, you can strike up a rapport and then the people will often tell you a lot more. You know, and they'll talk more openly about their experience. So I've found.
Yeah.
And it's just, it'll never, ever stop fascinating me. The whole concept that most people, you know, most of the public don't have yours and mine's fascination with the paranormal.
Yeah.
You know, out of every 100 people you bump into, I bet only 3 of them are as interested in the paranormal as you and I are. And the people that might be listening to us talk about this now. The rest of the public is kind of not that bothered by it. And in fact, if you try and talk to them about, oh, you know, I research ghosts, I write about ghosts, you're likely to get a raised eyebrow or two. And yet, so many of those other 97, if you like, have experienced something that they can't explain.
Yeah.
And that it would just never cease to fascinate me, that whole, it doesn't matter whether you believe in it or research it or have read about it. It's out there and it's doing it. Watch out when you're driving around corners and things, people.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's always the interesting thing about this, as you say. And I think, obviously, as your reputation has developed, Ruth, and you've become known as someone who's a very down-to-earth and balanced person who will treat witnesses with respect and take your time, as you say, to have a conversation with them where possible. It's amazing how often one story leads to another, or as you say there, you're looking for information about one particular area, and yet you'll end up getting 3 or 4 about something that you may never have even been aware of.
Absolutely. And I know I've mentioned to you before, you know, I've got my databases of things I want to investigate more, research more into. And I'm quite strict with my databases. I only put in it events that have happened within my lifetime. So I'm not particularly interested in, you know, such and such a castle that used to have the ghost of so-and-so clanking his chains and wandering around carrying his head back in the 1700s. Not that bothered. I want to know about paranormal happenings that have happened within my lifetime. So the only things that make it onto my databases are things that have happened sort of since the 1960s. She says, can you say her age? Nobody listened to that, right? I'm only 21. And even with that restriction on timelines, if you like, I started this research for this book number 6 thinking, oh, my main database is starting to get a bit low because I've, you know, filled 5 books worth out of it.
Yeah.
And just in researching for the roadmap, which is a separate database of ghosts that haunt roads, everybody that's spoken to me and all the other incidents that have come up have now refilled up the other database. So that's now chock-a-block full. I was skimming through it today to add something to it and thinking, oh my goodness, look at all those entries that I've now got, that I've now got to start and research because somebody's told me about this location and that location and the other location. So there's another. There's the next book already lined up. And I'm actually having to say to people now, look, this won't, what you're telling me won't fit in this book. It'll have to fit into the book after this one. So, you know, stacking them up for next year now. So be down once to retire, right?
Well, absolutely. And I think, with the greatest of honesty, though, Ruth, that's always a good thing. I mean, there's nothing worse than getting to a point where you think, right, what am I going to do next? You already kind of know what's going to happen already.
Absolutely. And the real joy of it for me is how even now, even, you know, researching for book number 6 now, it still feels as fresh to me as it did when I was researching for book number 1. Because it still hasn't bored me or made me feel jaded, or, you know, every single new encounter just fascinates me beyond belief. You know, every new story I get, no matter how small the snippet, I mean, this is one of the things I pride myself on. If somebody tells me that the ghost in their house slammed a door, then that's what's going in the book. Hmm. You know, the ghost in my house slammed a door. I'm not going to try and sex it up. I'm not going to try and make it sound more scary than it was.
Hmm.
Because that's, to me, there's enough television programs and supposed reality programs doing that as it is.
Hmm.
My aim is always to add to the research about the paranormal. You know, what is really going on? So, yes, if that's all that happened, that they had a door inexplicably slam, then that's what I'll write about. But I'll still find it absolutely fascinating because of the way that they're able to explain to me why there was something really odd about the door slamming that day, you know?
Mm.
It wasn't the wind, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So.
And I think that's one of the good things about your work, Ruth. As you say, it's not just the same old stories about the grey lady or the white man, or, you know, the haunted well in the old village. You know, these are very fresh, up-to-date encounters from people from all walks of life, from all parts of the British Isles. And I've always enjoyed that, as you say, sometimes the most mundane occurrence takes on a whole new aspect when you look at it in a balanced way.
Yes, and I think it brings it to life how the reality of the paranormal, because for me it is a reality, you know, I still haven't made my mind up what causes the phenomena. I am absolutely certain that phenomena occurs. You know, there are way too many people that experience it to say otherwise. And it's you know, it's that endless fascination with, well, what's occurring? What's causing that? And it is that mundane, that the fact that everybody comes across it in their day-to-day lives in places that, you know, it's not an old spooky ruin. It's not a haunted castle. It's, you know, it's somebody's 1970s built council house that they know fact was built on empty farmland beforehand. So there's no obvious connection that you'd think, oh, you know, haunting by a monk or haunted by a grey lady or, you know, a knight carrying his head under his arm, whatever.
Yes.
Yet it's haunted and yet it's got a poltergeist or, you know, whatever it might be. And it just seems to be that, to me, that is the more important tales.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, maybe back in the 1700s, that knight carrying his head around was a really important tale to the people then who witnessed it and experienced it. But if nobody's experiencing it now, to me, that's like, well, OK, that's great. But I want to know what people are seeing now.
Yeah.
Put out a post and say, I'm interested in such and such a place. And people will try to redirect me to the local famous haunting, for example.
Mm.
So a real example of that is Bluebell Hill in Kent. Very famous haunting. Very little substance to it when you actually research to it. You know, it's all hearsay. I've heard of somebody who, it's very hard to find anybody who says, I personally have seen. And it's been written about so many hundreds of times. It's not something I'm likely to ever want to write about unless somebody says, I personally have seen it.
Yeah.
And yet the number of times I get told, oh, you must mean Bluebell Hill, just because I'm asking about a road in Kent.
Yeah.
No. I'm not asking about Bluebell Hill. I'm asking about such and such a lane somewhere completely different.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
So, yes, people's minds do go to the big famous locations, if you like. But, yeah, read my books if you want to see what's really happening to real people in real lives.
Yeah, I think one of your stories that you included, and I think it's in These Haunted Times, Volume 2, has to be one of my favourite paranormal encounters, Ruth, which is the one which involves the man who was cooking sausages. And it always makes me chuckle. Obviously I've read your book several times, more than once. And that story always brings a smile to my face because I just find it so odd and so funny that we have something playing about with sausages.
Yes. I always refer to that one as the interdimensional sausage. And it's funny, you know, I always have a slight frisson of dread go through me when an interviewer like yourself says, oh, a story in such and such a book. And I think, oh God, please mention one that I can remember. because half of the trouble is, of course, having now written 5 books with hundreds of entries in every book.
Yes.
There are going to be ones that I struggle to remember without looking at it again afresh. You know? But that is one that sticks in my mind. Can't remember off the top of my head where it was, you know, where in the country. But yes, that was a chap and his girlfriend who were living together. And they had a Sunday morning routine. They treated themselves every Sunday morning to a fried breakfast, a nice fry up. And they'd been together some years. So like many couples that have been together a long time, who did what was kind of done by long practice, if you know what I mean. So they'd both go down to the kitchen and it was one of them would always fry the sausages. The other would always dish up the other ingredients. Somebody'd make the tea, but they always sort of dance the same dance, if you know what I mean, around the kitchen. And they always had 5 sausages, 3 for him, 2 for her. and they used those frozen sausages that come in a packet of lots and lots of sausages.
Yep.
So you can sort of tip 5 out of the packet, if you know what I mean, straight out of the freezer and cook them straight from the freezer. And this particular morning they were chatting away and they were frying the sausages and sorting it out. And sort of moving around the kitchen in their normal way, and she tipped the sausages out onto a plate, you know, that he'd laid on the table ready for everything to be tipped out onto, turned away to put the frying pan on the stove. He turned around to put the toast down or whatever he was doing and said, oh, you haven't done enough sausages. Well, yeah, I have. I've done 5 as you. Well, there's only 4. No, I've done 5. I counted 5. And then he realised that actually, at one point, he'd also, you know, sort of given the frying pan a stir and that there had been 5. So they both stare at this plate, which is a plain white plate. So the sausages, you know, can't kind of hide.
Yeah.
Although this one seems to have managed it. And they both stare at it in astonishment. Well, that's weird. I'm sure there were 5 a minute ago. And he said he actually got down on his hands and knees and looked under the table, thinking, well, it must have rolled off. No sign of this sausage anyway. So, well, we must just have made a mistake. There must just have been 4. You know, we've miscounted. Oh, well, never mind. Carry on laying out the things. Turn around a second later, there's 5 sausages on the plate. And he said, it's the weirdest thing, but they both stood there and stared at 4 sausages and discussed the fact that there were only 4 sausages and looked for the missing 5th sausage and definitely wasn't there. Turned round, turned back, sausages reappeared. Love it.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's one of the rare situations with an apport. I can't think of many cases that involve food. I can think of, you know, as we've talked about before, keys and passports and pictures and things and cups disappearing or going for a journey somewhere and then coming back eventually. But I can't remember many stories that involve cooked food disappearing for a short while.
No, I can't either. And in actual fact, when I was talking to him, because I did speak to this, he was telling me that when he tries to picture it in his memory now, and he looks at that plate in his memory, if you like, he's fairly sure he can see a sort of blurred space on the plate.
Yeah.
You know, like that film, was it Predator? Yes. It called? Where the alien from another planet could kind of blur its outline so that you were kind of looking through it.
Yeah.
And in his mind's eye, he can see that effect on the plate. And he said to me, I can't for certain say now that I'm just remembering it that way or I'm remembering it because that's how it looked. But yeah, so there is a suggestion that the sausage was actually hiding in plain sight all along.
Yes.
And blurring itself out of reality, which is why I like to call it the interdimensional sausage. It's just for a moment it decided to phase shift into a different reality. Why?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, always gives me a good chuckle, that story. It's one of my favourites in your collections, that. And I know we were speaking about it being October and suitably spooky, Ruth. We were mentioning about talking about some of your favourite spooky stories from These Haunted Times, Volume 2.
Well, we've got a couple of interesting ones. My favourite scary one, I think, and this is purely because It's a fear of mine, if you like.
Yes.
If this happened to me, I would run screaming. This happened in a house in Devizes in Wiltshire. And it's a correspondent of mine called Honey, who herself is a twin. And this happened when she was a child, so, you know, quite some years ago, same sort of age as me. And it was a three-story, old-style, semi-detached house. There were a lot of happenings in that house, and I'm not going to go into all of them because there's too many. But essentially, before they bought the house, or before her parents, I should say, bought the house, there had been a suicide in the house, up in his bathroom. So it's quite possible that a lot of the activity was related around that. But this particular little snippet, in amongst all the other things that happened in the house, is the one that scared me the most. Which is weird when you get to hear it in a minute, to think that I'd quite happily face a suicide, but not this.
Yeah.
She shared a bedroom with her twin sister, obviously, and it was a room with bunk beds. And because they were twins, most of their toys they had in duplicate so that they wouldn't be squabbling, you know. So if one had a teddy bear, the other was bought the same teddy bear. You know, if one had some, I don't know, a toy train or whatever, they both had a toy train and so on. And they had a pair of matching dolls. This particular night, there was a thunderstorm in the middle of the night, which woke my correspondent, Honey, up. And she woke up with a start because of the thunder. Lay for a moment thinking, oh, blimey, that's a big storm, as you do. Turned to look across the room where the two dolls were sitting. And one of the dolls turns its head and looked at her as she was looking at it. I hate dolls at the best of times.
Yes.
And it's such a simple little memory of that doll turning its head to look at her. Apparently she screamed the place down and her mum and dad had to come rushing in, and she was so hysterical about this doll turning to look at her that they had to remove the dolls from the room completely. Don't blame them. And yeah, it's such a tiny thing, but for me, so incredibly creepy to have a doll turn and look at you.
Yeah, very much so. There's something about toys and the paranormal, I think, that maybe it's because people invest so much happiness in them, Ruth, that when they do something weird, it has a bit more resonance in regards to how people react to the event.
Maybe, because I can see what you're saying with that, because I do remember doing one particular ghost hunt in an old building in Warwick that had... One of the rooms was set up as a toy room, and I did find that the creepiest out of all the rooms. And I think that was something about, because you're juxtapositioning innocence and childhood against paranormal and spooky, and there's something about that mismatch that jars on your senses.
Yeah.
But for me, dolls are the absolute worst. I've even been to stay in hotels, but, you know, as part of my day job when I was still working full time before I partially retired. I used to have to travel a lot and stay in a lot of hotels. And if I walked into a hotel room and there was a doll in there, I used to ask the staff to take it out. I'm not sleeping in a room with that in there. The thing will get up in the middle of the night and walk around. You what? I am freaked out by them, it has to be said. And the other thing, so another story out of the same book, out of these haunted times, the other thing that completely creeps me out, you know, and I find particularly scary, is Ouija boards.
Yes.
I don't like Ouija boards. I don't like participating in them. I will try to avoid participating in them if I possibly can. Because I've had quite a few nasty experiences with them when I was a teenager and sort of early 20s. So it always resonates with me if somebody says they've, you know, had a horrible experience with a Ouija board, because I know exactly what they mean with the horrible, creepy feeling that comes with it.
Yeah.
And this particular tale was, again, it was a fairly simple one. It, you know, in terms of what happened, but this was in East Bergholt in the county of Suffolk, again a lot of years ago, but, you know, within my lifetime. The chap in question was about 16 years old at the time, and him and his mates had got into the habit of doing a Ouija board. And I think actually a lot of teenagers that kind of age get into the paranormal, for, you know, it's a bit like you go through a phase of dinosaurs when you're six, don't you? And
yes.
Wanting a pony when they're sort of 10. And a lot of teenagers go through a paranormal phase. and as part of that, you know, dabbling with a Ouija board, certainly through the sort of 70s, 80s and 90s, seems to have been quite a thing.
Yeah, definitely. I speak from personal experience, Ruth. Yes.
Stuff themselves in the shed at the bottom of the garden with some Scrabble letters and a nicked glass, you know. From trying, you know, because they'd done several at this point, and they'd learned that the best way to do it was to use a long-stemmed wine glass.
Mm.
Because the glass with the long stem is the hardest to fake it moving.
Yeah.
Because although you can very subtly and gently push it away from you fairly successfully, you can't get the thing to move left or right or come back towards you with any success. Because the minute you try to put that sort of pressure on it, it just tips over because of the long stem.
Yeah.
So to not, this little group of lads, to not accuse each other of cheating, they'd learn that the best thing to do was to use this long-stemmed wine glass.
Mm.
Because then they knew it couldn't be moved in all directions.
Mm.
So they're using this wine glass. And this particular day, they'd had some success in the past. And they'd, you know, apparently got some names, particularly one he remembered was Hazel. They kept getting Hazel come through. But this particular day, all they kept getting was it just kept spelling out again and again, Ed the Head. And it spelled this out several times until they were actually getting quite cross with it. It's like, you can't just keep saying Ed the Head, you know, you have to tell us something. So then it started just saying dog's eyes, over and over again, just spelling out dog's eyes. And then it started saying watching you. And the more it did this, just repeating phrases, the more and more creeped out they were getting.
Yeah.
Because it started to feel malevolent as opposed to informational, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And they were trying to figure out why does it keep saying dog's eyes? None of us own a dog. You know, so there isn't a dog watching us. And he kept saying watching you. And then they suddenly clocked that there was a poster on the wall of the shed of the cartoon character Snoopy.
Right.
Who was, of course, a dog. So they asked it, are you watching through the poster? Yes. Which, again, just made them feel quite creepy.
Mm.
And at this point, the only response they could get it to give then was die and dead over and over and over again. And they got so scared that they sort of jumped up from the table they were sitting around. The glass smashed. And they legged it and never did a Ouija board again.
Mm.
And I must admit, I don't blame them because I won't do them either.
Yeah, I suppose that is odd because, yeah, as I said, you know, I've done more than my fair share in my younger years, Ruth. And it is strange that the vast majority of times it's just nonsense or silly things or whatever. And there's a handful of occasions where we witness something weird in a similar kind of vein. And they've stayed with me for the best part of 30 years.
Well, I think that's partly because of that whole, when it's something that is genuinely out of the norm,
mm.
and then you can say, you know, supernatural or paranormal, just out of the norm, that's when it is does stick with you, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because your whole brain and all your senses are going, that doesn't fit. That little snippet, however little it is, doesn't fit into the normal world. So what do I do with that, you know? And I think that's why they stick so rigidly in our minds.
Mm.
And why people will sort of, you know, give me, but there was the one thing that I still can't explain or tell me their story. Because when you've had something happen that you actually cannot find an explanation for, it really does stick with you.
Yeah. It is interesting as well, like you say there. It does seem to be quite a cultural phase that we went through and kids of our age at that period, Ruth. I'd be very interested to, well, not that I want to go investigating and to something like that, but it would be very interesting to see if that kind of thing still goes on. You know, a group of friends just mucking about in a shed somewhere, playing about with a Ouija board, because like you say, it does seem to be something that harks back to the 70s, the 80s and the 90s, whereas these days you don't seem to hear many stories involving a Ouija board, especially not in the UK, it would seem.
Well, it is a very interesting point, actually, because I mean, like you say, certainly through the 70s, 80s, 90s, every teenager did it in the UK. It's so common. But stories from the 2000s of kids doing it, I can't think of any. Maybe one that I've been told that's more, you know, is from sort of 2000 onwards.
Mm.
You see, that's when, if you think about it, from, you know, the early 2000s onwards, that's when smartphones and laptops and tablets and things all started to come into prevalence. Mm. So did they sweep out, if you like, things like the Ouija board that were, you know, physical toys or physical, whatever you want to call them?
Yeah.
Making up your own entertainment by providing entertainment. Do any kids that are interested in the paranormal these days, are they more likely to download onto their phone or tablet or whatever, you know, one of these supposed spirit box apps or
yes,
create your own ghost photograph app or and actually do something that they know isn't true? So they're already suspending their belief before they start, if you know what I mean. Mm. They know it's a game they're playing rather than they could be tapping into something.
Mm.
Maybe it is just a cultural shift that kids these days are brought up with media, whereas, you know, in the decade previous to that, you made your own entertainment much more, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. Plus, I suppose there's more of it on television as well, Ruth. You know, most paranormal television shows in the last 20 years have done Ouija boards and table tipping and things like that. And maybe it's because people are exposed to it more that they don't seem to want to do it themselves. Whereas when we were kids growing up, you might read a scary book or occasionally find a ghost story book in a library or anything, but you never really saw anything like that on television at all.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, my fascination with the paranormal, as I've probably explained lots of times in the past, I'm sure, started when I was very young because we lived in a house with a poltergeist. And so my interest in trying to find out, well, what the heck's happening, started from quite a young age. And you're absolutely right. Back then, I started my databases, although back then there was a card file system, not a database, but same, you know, concept. I used to really struggle to find books on the supernatural. I used to have to trawl through the library to find one. And I used to visit bookshops a lot and trawl through the old books there trying to find books about ghosts.
Mm.
They just weren't as popular, you know, in my teenage years. So yes, when you found one, they were kind of almost like forbidden material, you know, really exciting. Whereas these days, of course, you know, they're readily available. And like you say, there's so much television, so many ghost hunting type shows, you know, from America, from the UK, from all over the place, where you can watch live investigations. You know, you can watch a medium at work. You can, like you say, watch people using Ouija boards and what have you. And whether that's because it's televised in that way, and I'm sure some of those shows will have been making a genuine attempt. I know some weren't and have been exposed for it, but I'm sure some of them will have been genuinely trying to, you know, capture evidence, particularly in the earlier days. And
yes,
has that kind of, because we've got a generation of teenagers who are used to playing games online, are used to watching a lot of films online where they know it's not real, do they just see the paranormal the same way now? Well, it's not real because we see it online. I don't know. It's an interesting cultural experiment. Yeah,
it is. Mm. Food for thought there. I think I've asked a question that's ended up leaving me needing more answers, Ruth.
Yeah. That's right. I hope it's wrong, but I'm still interested, because otherwise I'll run out of people to want to buy the books.
Yeah. Well, I think that if there's any... I don't think this is the other thing as well, is although we're looking at that cultural aspect of it kind of falling out of fashion, I don't think the paranormal's ever been as popular as it is right now, as you say, because there are so many television shows. These days, we don't have to scratch around second-hand shops to get paranormal literature, Ruth. It's everywhere, you know what I mean? You go on Amazon, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books about a variety of subjects, and you can find books on counties and towns and cities and countries now.
Yeah.
You can put the television on, and I will guarantee you there will be a paranormal show on a channel right now.
Absolutely. And I think you're really right with that, that it is so readily available that maybe that will spark even greater interest. Perhaps it'll have the opposite effect.
Mm.
You know, that more and more people will want to become actual paranormal investigators. and maybe that'll turn out to be a really, really good thing.
Mm.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, isn't it? That we're living in an age where, like you say, and it's any subject of the paranormal as well, whether you happen to be, you know, into aliens or the fae or cryptids or ancient alien theories or ancient technology theory or any of these subjects, and the paranormal along with it. There is so much information now that you can, like you say, you can just, you know, tap away on your phone and pull it up to look at, that perhaps that will spark a new generation of kind of super investigators who already have this knowledge easily readily available.
Yeah.
So they can take the next leap forward, if you know what I mean.
Mm. Yeah, and especially when you, as you mentioned there, and you're talking about apps and things, and I think as the technology develops and things get cheaper and more easily available, maybe it's going to make it easier for people to start doing paranormal research and investigations.
Maybe it will. I mean, I'm a little bit old school. I don't like using the apps or anything that's been built specially to be a paratool, because I always have a suspicion, and I'm sure this is because I've spent 2 decades of my career as an investigator.
Yes.
You know, I'm naturally suspicious and want to check everything out. I just naturally assume that that's been tampered with and it's got some kind of algorithm or chip or something inside it that produces results that appear to be random, you know.
Mm.
So if I'm going ghost hunting, I like to use the basic old-fashioned tools, which is an EMF meter, that is one designed for an electrician who is generally looking for an EMF field in a wall because he's looking for where the electricity supply is. So you know it is definitely calibrated just to go off if it finds EMF, nothing else.
Mm.
I like to use just an ordinary digital voice recorder. I've got a small one that I, you know, bought very cheaply, and it does nothing but record and playback. That's all it does. Nothing enhanced, nothing special. I like to use a laser temperature pointer thing. Not quite sure what the temperature is, but again, I've bought it from, you know, a tool company rather than a paranormal company, and it's one that, you know, plumbers and again electricians and so on would use to see if there's a heat source in a wall.
Yeah.
So, you know, you point a laser at it and tells you what the temperature of the surface it's pointing at is. So that makes it quite good for seeing changes in, you know, fluctuation in temperature if you're out and about.
Hmm.
And obviously just a good old-fashioned camera. I use the camera on my phone, and I also use, I've got a Fujitsu XS1 camera, digital camera that I use.
Hmm.
Because I know that those pieces of equipment are only doing their job, you know, what it says on the tin they're capable of doing. Nobody's put a chip in them. Nobody's put an algorithm in them. So if they give a result, then that's because they found a result, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And similarly, if I want to use trigger objects, I favour those little cat toys with the lights inside them.
Yes.
Because you have to physically knock one of those to make it light up.
Mm.
And you can, you know, you can play with them for hours. You can try tilting them. You can try blowing on them. They won't go off unless something actually moves them.
Yeah.
So if you're using one, you know, on an investigation and it lights up, it's because something moved it.
Yeah.
The question then is, what moved it? You know?
Yes, exactly.
But you know that it's gone off because something moved it. So, yeah, I am a bit old school, and I favour the very simple tools of the trade, if you like, because then I know that my results are not tampered with in any way.
Yeah, I must admit I'd used one of those ghost apps and downloaded it for a bit of fun. Ruth and I discovered that I seem to be living with about 10 ghosts in my little flat a few years ago.
and I've watched some of those EMF meters that are sold specifically for ghost hunting.
Yeah.
They have all the very flashy lights on them and what have you. And if you sit and while somebody else is doing an investigation and watch them for long enough, you have to watch them for a couple of hours, but you can discern a pattern in when they go off.
Yes.
Which suggests that they're just following an algorithm of apparently random flashing. Mm. But if you watch it long enough, you see the random repeat itself.
Yeah.
You know, and then all of a sudden you realise that they're designed at just the right interval to get somebody's interest and then apparently die away.
Yeah.
So, yes, I'm very suspicious of those, I must admit. Whereas if my EMF meter goes off, it doesn't have any flashing lights or anything, because you wouldn't need that as an electrician.
Hmm.
You know, if my EMF shows an EMF spike, it's because it's found an EMF spike, you know?
Yeah.
Which could be because it's found an electricity source. You know, there could be cable in the wall or whatever, but that's the whole point of making sure you do your base check first of all, you know?
Yeah. Definitely. And I think sometimes you can use too much technology, or like you say, you have to be, I wouldn't necessarily say suspicious, but I think you have to sort of take a step back, Ruth, and think, well, if I'm buying a tailored product for paranormal research, there's a good chance that that will be designed to give the result that the person purchasing it perhaps wants.
Yeah, that would be my suspicion, yeah. So I would rather buy something that can't have been tailored. But it's the same old thing, isn't it? People do like fast results. And the plain truth of hunting the paranormal, any of us who, you know, do it so much as we do, is that you will sit for hours and hours and hours and hours in cold, drafty, sometimes wet locations, and absolutely nothing will happen.
Yeah.
Literally, you know, if you see a barn owl, you've had a good night because something happened, you know?
Mm.
A lot of the time it's just sitting there doing nothing.
Yeah.
Because that's how the paranormal is. It might show its face, it might not. But I always liken that to, if you're a bird watcher, as opposed to a paranormal investigator, then you know you might have to sit for hours before you see the long-tailed tit or the, you know, yellow hammer or whatever it is you've gone out to look for.
Mm.
You don't expect one to hop across your line of view the minute you sit down.
Yeah.
And I think paranormal investigators need to remember that and not try to buy tools that give them a quick gratification hit, you know?
Yeah.
But to know that, or another analogy to look at it, you know, most of us that have a garden in the UK will have a robin living in it.
Mm-hmm.
In most areas of the UK, robins are very territorial birds. Most of them tend to stick to one or two gardens, you know, that their territory is quite small.
Yeah.
So any given urban garden of quite a small thing is likely to have one robin using it as its territory.
Hmm.
And yet the homeowner will only see that robin a few times a year.
Yeah.
And that's a combination of, well, because they only spend X amount of time out in their garden. When they are out in the garden, they only spend X amount of the time paying attention as to whether the robin's there or not.
Yeah.
But of those occasions, only so many times will the robin happen to pop out at that moment.
Hmm.
You know, so over a given year, you might only see your robin a handful of times, but that doesn't mean to say he isn't there all the time.
Mm.
And I think the paranormal is very similar. It's probably around us all the time, but it's only sometimes when it happens to be popping out at the same moment that you happen to be paying attention.
Yes.
Do you wonder how many times are people accidentally seeing ghosts or apparitions and not realizing, because at that moment they weren't paying attention?
Yeah.
And they thought it was, I mean, like the chap I started talking about right at the start of this, if that had been earlier in the day, so it wasn't in the middle of the night, so there were other people around and other things happening, and that chap had walked up to him and spoken to him and then disappeared, would he have forever believed, oh, well, my attention must have been taken by the other six blokes in the yard at that moment?
Yeah.
I just didn't see where he went. And would he kind of dismissed it as a bit more, although he kind of knows it's inexplicable, but does the fact that it happens in a more busy location, would that mean your mind would dismiss it more easily? Does that happen more often than we know? Who knows?
Yeah, I think it is often interesting that what the situation is when it occurs, like you say, because if there's other things, you think, oh, well, that was a bit weird. Scratch your head about it. But like you say, if it's in the middle of the afternoon, you probably think, oh, well, you know, you could have wandered off, gone over here, gone there. But when it happens the middle of the night, there's nobody else there, that's a different kettle of fish entirely.
Yes. And I often get asked why, because, I mean, anybody who follows me on social media will see that a lot of the ghost hunting I do is during the day. I will visit a lot of haunted locations during the day. Oh, are you supposed to go ghost hunting at night? No. The only vantage of going at night is that it is quieter. So therefore, you're able to usually sit undisturbed in a place and pay attention to what's going on around you.
Mm.
But if you're good at doing that anyway, like, you know, like I've trained myself to be, I mean, like I say, 2 decades of my life was as an investigator, and one of my jobs was following people. So I spent a lot of time sitting behind bushes waiting for somebody to come and then following them.
Yes.
So you're training yourself to sit quietly and just observe. It doesn't matter whether you do that day or night, if you've trained yourself to sit and quietly observe what's going on around you.
Mm.
You know, in my experience and with my huge databases that we've mentioned, there is no pattern to there's, you know, is it day or night or any other time of the day? It happens when it happens. And whether you happen to be doing something totally normal, you know, like ringing up the changer to till at that moment, or just getting out of your car to put petrol in it, or just driving over to see your Auntie Gladys and it happens to be night or whatever. Mm. It doesn't seem to have any rhyme or reason. People will see things all day, every day, if they're going to see them.
Yeah.
Because it's night or day doesn't seem to be relevant.
No.
So, yeah, I'm as fully ghost hunt in the daylight.
Very much so. And that kind of leads me into one of my favourite creepy stories from These Haunted Times, Volume 2, which is the very interesting story about a gentleman. I believe he was at or near Great Cressingham in Norfolk, Roof, and he was driving along a road after visiting a friend. And as he's driving along, something catches his eye in his footwell of the passenger side. And in front of his eyes, a buckle appears, and then something just begins to manifest.
Oh, do you know, this is one that creeped me out. I do remember this one. Can't quite remember where it was either. But yes, exactly that. He's driving along, the light shining off something, what caught his eye, first of all. So he glanced down into the passenger footwell, and there was something metallic glinting.
Mm.
So he sort of glanced again. And as he watches, sort of trying to watch the road and watch this at the same time, this forms a buckle and then a shoe and then a shin and then knees and then, you know, right up into a person sitting next to him, dressed in old fashioned, you know, breeches and stockings and button shoes, you know.
Yeah.
By which point the poor guy is kind of plastered himself against his driver's door, trying not to crash the car.
Yes.
Don't stop the car because he's stuck in the car with the whatever this is now sitting next to him, grinning at him. Rushes home, rushes in, you know, gets out of the car, legs it in. And of course, his mum says, "You look like you've seen a ghost." No, Sherlock. You know, and he said, literally as white as a ghost himself, and really shocked. And he was only a young lad at the time, sort of late teen, you know, not long had the car. You know, not long been driver. And he didn't dare go out on his own after dark for about 6 weeks afterwards.
Yeah.
Which, when I know, for a young lad of that age is, you know, unheard of.
Yes.
You know, out they get. But it really scared the bejesus out of him. It really did. And understandably, I think. I think that's one of my horrors is please, 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 whatever else you do paranormal, do not get in my car with me. Or... even worse, and this I've always had a fear of this, do not get on the back of my motorbike with me.
Mm.
Okay? Just leave my vehicles out of it. You can manifest any way you like, just not in my vehicles or on my motorbike, please.
Yeah. The thing about that is that he still finds that experience extremely distressing, even though it happened 20, 30 years ago, Ruth. And it's a remarkable one as well, because... I suppose the key question is, why on earth is some old-fashioned person appearing in his car?
Well, you know, that is just, that is one of the absolutely perennial questions, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, from the dress he's describing, that could be anywhere from sort of, say, 1500s-ish through to, say, late 1800s-ish, I would guess. I'm sure a, you know, historical costume expert would be able to put actual possible date ranges on that, but something around that cut. So we're talking a good 300 year span at least, where a chap could have been wearing some sort of buckled shoe, stockings and breeches type outfit. And clearly that has nothing to do with a modern car, clearly. And clearly that car cannot have had anything in it, you know, that the ghost was attached to, or, you know, anything like that. So if we accept the premise that an apparition like that is the spirit of a dead person, then what on earth was that dead person doing, thinking, I'll just pop into this car and scare this poor lad?
Yes.
And please stop doing it. Yeah. don't do it. Because, you know, why on earth would that spirit, if that's an intelligent haunting, and by intelligent we mean something that can interact with its surroundings, you know, as opposed to just a playback or a, you know, time slip or whatever. Why on earth would it choose to do that? Just, absolutely mind-boggling. And it always makes me think, is this further proof that this type of, if you like, mischievous or interactive in some, like the sausage story, you know, yeah, anywhere where the paranormal is definitely interacting with the viewer, is that actually some other form of entity rather than the ghost of a dead person, you know, the spirit of a dead person, a dead person from 1800 and whenever or whatever? Is that another entity who takes on the form of something in order to cause mischief, fear? Is this where all our tales of boggarts and sprites and elves comes from? Creatures that like to cause wonder and terror, and is that what we're talking about here? You know, is this the reality of a boggart, for instance? And, you know, made famous in the Harry Potter films.
Yeah.
Term that had dropped out of usage, but I expect a whole generation knows it now.
Yeah.
You know, a boggart is something which takes on a form that it knows the person will find frightening. And they're, you know, an ancient part of British mythology, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it mythology or do they actually exist? And does that give the explanation of what on earth is this apparently 1700s or 1800s guy doing popping into a car somewhere? The answer is because he's not a 1700s or 1800s guy. He's a boggart or a sprite or whatever. But the reality is, however we choose to define the reason behind what the chap saw, the reality is he did experience it and it did happen. You know, and it, like you quite rightly said, it's terrified him for all these years and stuck with him, you know. And it was a long, long time before he ever drove down that road again. And I have to say, I've got sympathy with that because I saw an apparition that I'd been looking for. I'd been out hunting and I saw it in December 2019. And here we are coming up for December 2021 before long. And OK, there's been lockdowns in between when I wasn't able to go out and drive. But nevertheless, I still have been utterly unable, even as a paranormal researcher with as much experience as I've got and all the, you know, sightings and things I have experienced over the years, I still have not been able to bring myself to drive back down that road on my own at night.
Yeah.
Not one. And I've tried, I've argued with myself, you know, and I've set off on my way to somewhere. Right, you're going to go down that road because it's on the way. No, last minute, I veer off and go the other way. Just can't do it. Too scared in case I see it again. And yet that's me, who's somebody who's actively goes out and seeks the paranormal, has lived with a poltergeist, could be argued to say is quite used to the paranormal popping into her life.
Yeah.
And yet this one thing just, and it didn't do anything. It wasn't even looking at me. It was looking the other way.
Yeah.
Never even saw my face, just saw it from the behind. And yet it terrified me. Can't explain why. I just know it did, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, creepy.
I think that the interesting thing about that is that when we spoke about this last time, you were on about a couple of other people that had been. I actually know the people that went, so they've told me about what happened to them, Ruth, that they were driving up and down the road for a while and nothing seemed to be happening. And then all of a sudden, something just freezing cold just passed through the car.
Yeah, absolutely. And me, that's one of my favourite results, because I always hope that somebody will be reading my books and will think, oh, we'll go and investigate that spot that Bruce talked about. So to find, you know, like in that case, your friends that did, I was thrilled to bits when they wrote to me and said, oh, we've been investigating your road. And, you know, it took us a while, but something happened in the end and it wasn't, you know, as dramatic as you had. But, you know, they had this old sensation. And since they wrote to me, I found another person who, as a child, used to think of that road as the spooky road.
Yeah.
And whenever her parents used to drive along it, would shut her eyes and not dare look out the window, but she never knew why. She just had that feeling.
Yeah.
So there's obviously something along there. Is it the spirit of this heavyset chap that I've spoken about before? Or is it something else that's, you know, just manifesting itself in a way to scare people?
Yeah. And it is interesting that, you know, we're looking at three different encounters. Are all very different, Ruth. Like you say, this woman as a child just didn't know why, she just didn't like it, but she just didn't want to look. You obviously saw something. The other people had this temperature change that unsettled them a great deal. And once again, it's one of those aspects of this is do different people have different reactions to whatever's happening there? Like, you saw something, somebody else felt something, somebody else just had this overriding fear of dread despite not witnessing anything.
And I've got another two accounts on that road. No, tell a lie. Two, three, four, five accounts of people who've seen it on that road. And because it first came to my attention from an elderly chap who told me about it. Did you know such and such road was haunted? There's this figure that I've seen along it, and a couple of other people I know have seen it. No, I didn't. I'll start researching it. I then found two more accounts. And in one of those, it was a lady who responded to my request, you know, because I wrote out on social media like I do. And she responded to my request and said, I can't believe you're asking about that road. My husband and I saw something along there about 10, 15 years ago. And to this day, we've argued about whether what we saw was a real person or not. And they'd been on their way out to somewhere at about 3 o'clock in the morning. They were going on holiday or something, you know, so they were setting off really early. And they drove this bit of road, which is quite a rural lane, you know, that's kind of a back run between locations. It's not the obvious route you'd get from A to B. It's one of those little lanes that you use if you're local and you know that it also goes from A to B, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so, it's not the kind of place where anybody would normally be in the middle of the night, not other cars or anything, because it doesn't really get used as a main thoroughfare.
Yeah.
But they were driving along, and as they came around this particular bend where it's nearly always seen, they're standing in the road facing their car. So this time, this couple actually saw his face, was this figure, very similar to how I describe him. And the husband actually had to brake and swerve because he was standing in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
And he swerved round it and they carried on. And then the both of them, with him still driving, discussed about what they'd just seen and who on earth is that standing in the road at 3 o'clock in the morning. And they couldn't make their minds up whether he'd been wearing a longish jacket or could it maybe even have been a dark coloured dressing gown. What if this chap had dementia and was out wandering in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
What if he was in need of help? Should they turn the car around and go and help him? And she told me when she contacted me, they never were able to explain why, but they argued it backwards and forwards in the car and in the end sort of convinced themselves that it was better not to go and look.
Mm.
And she said, but kind of your lizard part of your brain was kind of, no, it's better not to go and look.
Mm.
But the rational side was saying, well, why on earth not? What if that's an old chap who's, you know, has wandered out of the house in the middle of the night and he's got dementia and he's not very well and he needs help? Or what if it's somebody whose car had gone in the ditch or, you know, whatever? Why on earth would somebody be on that lane in the middle of the night? We ought to go and help. And they sort of rationalised it to themselves as to why they weren't going back and helping.
Mm.
Because it could be one of these traps where people, you know, lure a car into stopping by pretending something's wrong. But even that doesn't make any sense as a possibility because, like I just mentioned, nobody uses this road as a thoroughfare.
Yeah.
So if you set a trap on it deliberately, you know, intending to flag down a passing motorist and then steal their car or whatever, you could be waiting there for 5 or 6 hours before a car came past.
Yeah.
You wouldn't do it on that bit of road. You'd choose a bit of road which was isolated enough to get away with it, but busy enough that you'd only have to wait an hour or so before a car came along, you know?
Mm.
So, yeah, again, describing that same weird feeling of dread and wrongness somehow about the encounter that they just couldn't explain to themselves.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well that, obviously, regardless, like you say, Ruth, common sense would be if you see something weird like that at that time of night, you do think, oh, well, that's a bit odd. It could be somebody who needs some help. But to then think, well, I don't. We can't go back. We've got to just carry on. I think is a very interesting emotional response, especially if there's more than one person as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because I'm pretty sure, if there'd been somewhere else in the car with me, especially with my ghost hunting head on, I would have turned the car around and gone back to look for it.
Mm.
But because I was on my own, and it, like I say, it had this really scary feeling about it, which I just can't explain, I couldn't bring myself to turn the car around and go and look for it. I couldn't. And yet, all the times I go ghost hunting and all the times when something has actually happened and my normal immediate reaction is to go straight back into that room or that, you know, whatever, immediately and try and replicate whatever just happened or try and debunk it or try and find sense for it, you know?
Mm.
So for me to not is completely out of character for me.
Yeah.
And yet I can't explain why I had such a strong feeling that I could not turn that car around and go back. Because like I say, he wasn't even facing me. I never even saw his face.
Yeah.
So I couldn't even claim, you know, looked evil or gave me an evil glare or anything like that, because he was facing away.
Yeah.
I was just looking at the back of a man's shoulders, and yet more scary than anything else, you know, on all my travels of ghost hunting.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's no rhyme or reason, really, as to what will scare and won't.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's often interesting. I think there are a couple of stories in the book as well where people don't actually see anything, Ruth. They hear things. I think there's one where somebody's on a lane and they hear a motorbike approaching. So they get to the side out of the way to let the motorbike come past. And they and the sound just goes past them, but there's nothing there. That, I think, is often as peculiar as seeing something that looks odd or just appears or disappears. When it's a sound-based paranormal event, you know, obviously people can sometimes hear funny noises in houses or buildings and pubs and hotels and whatever. But when you're in a country lane and the sound of a motorbike passes you and there's nothing there, I think that is probably as frightening as you can expect, because you've no idea what's going on at that point.
And it's a surprisingly common phenomena I've discovered in my research. Not necessarily the sound of a motorbike, but the sound of something that comes past you.
Yes.
So whether it's a motorbike or a car or footsteps, or quite often horses' hooves.
Yes.
Seems to be quite where the person, even in broad daylight, but again, yes, at night, whatever, is out and about, and they hear something coming, which they can clearly identify from the sound, and the sound passes them and carries on down the road, pathway, whatever, and yet there's nothing to be seen. and you're left stood there feeling like a prize chump, but also absolutely at a loss to explain what just happened, because the sound is as plain as day. I can actually remember, it puts me in mind, I don't know if you've ever heard of St Mary's Church in Pop Hill in Bedfordshire.
No, I haven't.
There's a very famous location for hauntings, insofar as it got a reputation in the 1960s. It's a ruined church, beautiful old location, but it got a reputation in the 1960s that it got devil worshippers using it. So it had quite a bad reputation. Well, of course, through the 70s and 80s and 90s, that was every teenager in the whole of Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire wanted to go to Clop Hill Church to see if they could see these devil worshippers.
Yes.
A real hangout place for teenagers for all those decades.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of paranormal research of it. And there's, you know, if you go online, you can see YouTube clips of dark figures moving inside the what remains of the church and so on. Mm. Really is a lovely location. But like every other late teenager, early 20s, I went along on several occasions with crowds of mates hooning about in our cars and on our motorbikes up there. And on one particular occasion, we had three cars there, and we had parked the cars. Back then, it was the only property up the end of this lane. Now there's other properties that have been built up there since. But back then it stood on its own up the end of this lane, and it was quite a long dirt track lane to get to it. And we'd parked the cars. It was after midnight, and we parked the cars in such a way that they're kind of facing inwards towards each other with the lights on. So it created a pool of light in the middle of the cars, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
And we were stood in the middle of that pool of lights, smoking cigarettes and winding each other up about the ghosts and what have you.
Yeah.
When we heard the sound of a chap walking his dog coming down the lane towards us. And it was plain as anything, the sound of footsteps and the chinking sound of a dog's lead.
Mm.
And we all carried on chatting. And we kind of looked at each other and thought, oh, I wonder if there's somebody come to complain that we're out here at this time of night. We couldn't see him approaching because we're stood in this circle of light. And so that means, of course, our night vision is gone for seeing beyond the circle of light, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
We can hear him walking towards us. So as he gets to the edge of the circle of light, we all politely step up to one side and sort of create a path down the middle for him to walk through. And the sound walked on through the circle of light and on down the lane. But there was absolutely nothing to be seen. And we were just looking at each other with sort of like, what the heck just happened? Because we'd separated to create a pathway between us, and the sound walked between the group of us. So, you know, we were on either side of it. And all of us pinpointed the sound as being in the middle of the group. So it wasn't even a case of weird acoustics or mistaken from where the sound was coming from. The sound clearly walked through the group of people.
Yeah.
And of course, in my later years researching now, what's actually meant to horn that lane is the sound of a horse, with sometimes with a rider, sometimes not. And I've often wondered since, I wonder if we mistook the sound of footsteps and chinking. And because we've got modern minds and don't think of horse riders straight away.
Yeah.
Because we think of footsteps and dog chains. Whereas if we went back and listened to it again, would we actually hear a horse's footsteps and a horse's bridle chinking?
Yeah.
If that's where our mind went to instead. And I've often wondered whether, you know, is that how your own cultural expectation interpret something? We interpret it as a dog and a dog walker because that's what it was most likely to be in our frame of reference, rather than a horse rider in the middle of the night.
Well, yes, absolutely. I think seeing somebody, even if you saw somebody in real life riding a horse late at night, Ruth, that would be peculiar anyway.
Absolutely peculiar in this day and age. Yeah, it's not something you would see. Whereas, of course, go back 100 years and seeing a horse being ridden at night would be literally an everyday occurrence, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, that's often the perception that your brain creates, doesn't it? Like you say, that it's late at night, so it has to be a man walking a dog. Can't be anything else.
Yeah, because that's the sound that our modern minds can most easily equate what we're hearing to. So, yeah, it's sounds, I think, can be just as scary as seeing something sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, I've certainly had my name called out.
Mm.
In a particular flat I lived in my early 20s, and it was a very, very peculiar little flat above an old shop, very old building. I would imagine the building was from the 1700s and odd.
Yeah.
But the way the flat was laid out, you entered through the back of the building, you went up some stairs outside the building, onto a flat-topped roof that formed like a little patio area, into the kitchen, you crossed the kitchen, and then you went down two steps onto a little tiny landing. Off that landing, there was one small bedroom and the lounge to your right. And on the left was a small flight of stairs leading up into a little tiny attic bedroom, which was so tiny that when you got to the flight of stairs, you had to literally go into the room on your hands and knees because the ceiling was so low there.
Right.
But yeah, the flight of steps kind of went into the ceiling, if you know what I mean. So there wasn't room up to get through. And this particular evening, friends had come round and were sitting in the lounge, and I'd gone into the kitchen to make everybody coffee. So I'd made all the coffee for however many people around, I can't remember now for sake of argument, say six of us.
Yeah.
And I put the six cups on a tray. So I'm walking from the tray, from the lounge, from the kitchen through to the lounge, which means I've got to navigate this little steps down. So if you can imagine, I'm carrying a round tray with six cups on it, and I'm looking down at the cups and looking down at my feet and being very careful not to spill it. And I'm navigating those steps and turning to my right to move into the lounge when a voice from my left up these dark stairs, which led up to what I was using as my bedroom, somebody went, really clearly.
Mm.
And I went, yeah, just hang on a second, thinking one of them had gone up to my room. And that would have been weird enough, except that about half an hour later, my brother came home, who'd been on a late shift.
Mm.
And he came bursting into the place and said, you'll never guess what's just happened to me. You mean all that? Well, you'll never guess what's just happened to Ruth. Why? What's happened to you? So I was just driving home and somebody just leaned forward through the back of my van and gone, Neil, Neil, in my ear from the back of my van.
Ooh.
Of course, we all just looked at what's just happened to Ruth, but from upstairs. And we have zero explanation for that. Absolutely no explanation for why or who or what or only time it ever happened, only spooky thing that ever happened in that flat that wasn't Ouija board related. Who knows? But absolutely a clear sound, my name being called twice, and my brother, you know, said his name was called twice.
Yeah. I remember once being somewhere, Ruth, and we were downstairs, like you said, there was a few of us, I would say six or seven of us downstairs, having a few friends round, having a good night, and it was fairly early, it was about seven, half seven-ish. The night was just beginning, shall we say, so nobody was drunk or too tiddly, and we were literally just stood in this room talking, and then from above us, because it was in a house, from above us, it sounded like somebody had just run from one end of the upstairs to the other.
Wow.
And me and my friend looked at each other, and we were like, what? So we shot upstairs, because we thought, well, somebody must have got in the house. That's the only way. And obviously, the layout was, you had a bathroom and a small bedroom at the back, And then the main bedroom and a kind of like office come spare room to the side of that. So you couldn't run from one end of the upstairs to the other at all. You couldn't do it.
No.
And we shot upstairs. Nothing. All the windows were shut. The door was locked. Nobody had got in. And when we came downstairs, we was, oh, well, it must have been a cat. What? It big, like bang, 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 bang. Like somebody really running across the floorboards. And it was carpeted as well. So
again, doesn't make sense. Yeah.
And we were like, what? And it was all a bit weird. And like we were saying about people push things into little boxes and put them to one side. Everybody else was like, oh, well, it was probably the cat. Well, it's not a lion, you know.
And my cat isn't in the habit of wearing big boots.
And it was just one of those things. Nothing else ever happened. That was, you know, just a very odd thing. And it's always struck me that because the sound sounded like they'd run the entire length of the upstairs, but they couldn't.
No.
It was impossible.
And I wonder if the building had ever been laid out in such a way that that had been possible in earlier times.
Well, it was a fairly new build as well, Ruth. It wasn't have been something beforehand, but, you know, it was a semi-detached house in a, you know, a fairly new build sort of post-Second World War. So, I mean, something may have been there prior to it, but there was, you know, no reason or rhyme to it as well. Like I say, it was early evening. Everybody just sat about having a conversation and then bum, 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 bum.
It's so bizarre, isn't it? Because it's just like that, you know, figure we were talking about materialising in the car a little while ago.
Mm.
How do you rationalise it when it's not making any sense?
Yeah.
You know, yes, you can see a ghost of somebody from the 1700s or whatever, perfectly possible, I guess, but materialising in a car?
Yeah.
And yes, you can hear footsteps running the length of somewhere, but running the length of a building that doesn't have that layout,
yeah,
again, just doesn't make sense logically, does it? And yet there it was.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
there you are faced with, well, it doesn't matter whether it's logical or possible, or it happened. And that's what I'm stuck with, you know. It happened, and as the person, you know, like yourself witnessing it, as our chap in the car,
yeah,
you're stuck with living with the fact that you have this occurrence in your life that defies any kind of explanation you can apply to it that we currently know of.
Yeah.
And that's where your brain just, you know, some people will think, like your friends went, oh, well, it must have been the cat, and will kind of stick that in a box where they don't have to think about it.
Yes.
Whereas you that live in the house and are used to its sounds and used to the sound of your cat and know damn well that your cat isn't the size of a lion, can't rationalise it away that easily because you know that is not a sound the house can make, you know?
Yeah. And I think that leads into one of the final stories I want to touch on, which is talking about strange things that you can't kind of explain, Ruth. There's a gentleman called John who had done some furniture removal for a friend in York, and he was stopping in a pub on the outskirts of the city, and his sleep's disturbed by the sound of running water. Something's turned the sink on. So this chap gets up to turn the tap off, and as he's coming back to his bed, he notices that his door handle has started to go down, as if somebody on the other side's wanting to come into his room. And what I find interesting about this is people say, oh, well, he's woke up, he's half asleep. Clearly, he was of the presence of mind that he ends up hiding behind the door with a chair, ready to bash whoever's coming in because he thinks he's going to get robbed.
Yeah, so he's not asleep at that point, is he?
No. I mean, creepy door handle stories are always the best one, but this is one of those that it is a little creepy, this one.
Well, it really is. And I think, to be honest, because I had to spend so many years staying at hotels, it's another is creepy stories about hotels. Because I learned very early on, staying away, not to ask at the hotel desk as I signed in, have you got any ghosts?
Yes.
We're guaranteed I wasn't going to get a night's sleep. So, I mean, yeah, just the, again, it's the normality of that, isn't it? You know, you wake up in the middle of the night in a hotel room and somebody is trying your door handle. Could easily be somebody actually intending to come into the room and rob you, couldn't it?
Yeah.
You know, so it could be something entirely natural, entirely explicable, and entirely part of this world, horrible as it is, that you might have a burglar trying to get into your room in the middle of the night. But it, you know, in the case of this chap, you know, he flung that door open to confront them, and of course the corridor was totally empty both directions, nobody to be seen, and nowhere they could have disappeared that quickly. So he's left with a, well, what on earth was moving my door handle then, that I watched so clearly it do, you know?
Yeah. And it's the fact that it slowly goes down, and then it stops, and then it slowly begins to rise.
Well, it puts me in mind as well of a hotel I once stayed in. I can't quite, it was somewhere near Chippenham Way, sort of down Wiltshire Way, somewhere around there. And again, you know, I was staying down that way for work, just the one night. And it was a little old manor house, the hotel I'd booked into. And it only had, maybe 6 or 8 bedrooms, very small hotel. And it was one of these manor houses that looks like a kid's drawing from the front, you know, central doorway, windows either side going up, no lifts or anything. And the bedrooms were, each bedroom and ensuite bathroom was in a corner of the house, if you like. So each bedroom had 2 aspects to its windows. Very nice little place. I got there quite late in the evening. Can't remember why I'd been out so late with work, but I had.
Yeah.
I'd had something to eat before I got to the hotel, so just went up to my room and settled down quite quickly. Got ready for bed quite soon after I went to bed. In the middle of the night, I woke up needing the loo. So I got out of bed, went to the ensuite bathroom, used the loo, got back into bed, all without bothering to switch the light on, because as I said, the room was dual aspect, so windows on 2 walls.
Yeah.
So just the ambient, because I always leave the curtains open. I never sleep with the curtains shut. So just the ambient light from outside was enough to navigate round the room by.
Yeah.
I laid back down in the bed and I put my head on the pillow. I went to shut my eyes and clear as anything on the pillow next to me, somebody went, just really annoyed somebody by disturbing them. I lay there absolutely rigid and thought, that was right by my head. And then I tried to rationalise it away, like you do, thinking, oh, it must be the guest in the next room over that I can hear. Oh, hang on a minute. The bedhead is against one of the outside walls. Right, not the next door guest then, is it? And I lay there and I thought, well, I've got 2 choices here. I can either get up and leave in the middle of the night when I'm supposed to be staying here. I've got another day's work in the area tomorrow.
Yep.
Or I can ignore it. So I got my iPod out, put it on the pillow right where this noise had come from, and turned it on to play music really quietly, and thought to myself, ha, make a noise through that, ghosty. I went to sleep listening to my iPods as I couldn't hear any ghosts getting annoyed with me for getting up in the middle of the night. But it was literally that sound of annoyance that somebody makes when they tut at you.
Yeah.
Bizarre. And hotel rooms, don't ask when you are going to stay in a hotel.
Yeah. I think the last creepy story I want to touch on as well is another one that's set in Yorkshire as well, which is about a young lad, and I think he used the name Matthew in the book, whose dad was a taxi driver who had an encounter taking a passenger between York and Harrogate, Ruth. And this is one of those that I know, I think the first time we spoke, we were talking about situations where people in cars, there could be 3 or 4 people in a car, one person might see something and the others don't see anything. And this is one of those stories where his dad's driving this taxi and he suddenly slams on the brakes. Oh my God, I can't believe that. And the passenger's like, what are you doing? What's happened? Why have you done that?
And hadn't seen him at all. Yeah. And there's a surprising amount of stories like this where 2 people, one sees it, one doesn't.
Yeah.
And it you're always left with the, were they imagining it? Is that why one saw it, one didn't? And yet, you know, you counteract that with thinking most taxi drivers are used to working weird hours at night.
Yeah.
It's not like they're going to be like you or I might be if we were driving late at night, who perhaps don't do it as often, and, you know, we would be tired and perhaps a bit more prone, therefore, to imagining something or whatever.
Mm.
But for them, that's their usual working hours. You know, that's the middle of their working day.
Yeah.
They're as alert as they're ever going to be, aren't they? So why would he suddenly imagine something? You know, not to doing that and imagine so vividly that he actually performs an emergency stop with his taxi, which again is something a taxi driver isn't going to do lightly and throw his passenger around in the back seat.
Yeah.
And yet he sees it and she doesn't.
Yeah.
There's an, I can't remember whether it's in Roadmap, what, volume one, or whether it's in one of the Haunted Times volumes. I can't remember, but there's another story very similar where the lady was the passenger in a car that her husband was driving.
Mm.
And she saw a figure step out into the road and screamed and sort of grabbed the dashboard. And he kind of slammed the brakes on because she'd screamed.
Yeah.
And she was like, "Where did you go? Where did you go?" And he was like, "Why are you screaming?" She said, "Well, why did you stop?" He said, "Because you screamed."
Yeah.
But he'd never seen anything. She'd seen it. He'd merely reacted to her reaction, you know.
Yeah.
And brakes because she screamed and suddenly grabbed the dashboard like she'd seen something.
Yeah. I suppose taxi drivers as well, Ruth, are used to seeing people staggering home late at night. So often they're on full alert a lot more than we would be. As you say, they're used to these hours. But I think the realisation when it suddenly dawns on him that when his passenger says, "Oh, what did he look like?" And he suddenly realises that this person had a tri-horn hat on and was waving an old lantern, and the realisation kind of sets in that that's probably not a normal person that he's just seen.
Probably wasn't reacting to a real life person there. I've just seen something I shouldn't have seen. Yeah. It's just that's true, you see. It will happen to any of us. And it's because for him, that's the middle of his working day.
Yes.
You know, just another day at the office for him. And yet he encounters the paranormal.
Yeah. And he gets the typical British solution to a shock. He's offered a bracing cup of tea.
Yes, absolutely, because that will fix everything. Unless, like me, you happen to hate tea.
Oh, fabulous. Well, Ruth, it's been a real pleasure to have you back on the show. It's been far too long, and I know you're very busy trying to get the next book. So where can everybody keep up to date with your work? And if they've got any stories they want to share with you, how can they get hold of you?
I've got Twitter and Facebook, where people can easily keep up to date with what I'm up to. So just look up Ruth Roper Wild on either Twitter or Facebook. I have got Instagram, but I tend not to use it as much, and Pinterest, but so mainly Twitter and Facebook. And if you've got a story that you want to share with me, you want to have a conversation with me, just email me at wa-1400@outlook.com. And I'll be very happy to hear from you.
Fabulous. And all the books are available on Amazon and other notable publication selling sites.
Yeah, and they're all in paperback and ebook format. And you can also read them for free if you happen to have a Kindle Unlimited subscription. So yeah, there's three different ways of getting hold of them.
Lovely. And I look forward to the new one. Hopefully it will be with us whenever you can get it published. So I'm really looking forward to that because, like I say, I'm a big fan of your work. It's always lovely to spend some time talking all things spooky with you, Ruth, and I wish you the very best for this Halloween season.
Thank you, Paul. It's always really great to come on the show.